I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a brief history of how Supreme Court nominations became so nakedly political in the span of just 30 years. We'll spend this hour with journalist Michael Kirk, whose upcoming Frontline documentary chronicles the rapid rise of the Federalist Society and the slow burn of Mitch McConnell's three-decade revenge plot following the Democrats' deliberate effort to tank the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court back in 1987. We'll talk about why Bork was so unacceptable to Democratic Party leaders at the time and about how their victory in defeating his nomination has cost them more than they may have bargained for. Our conversation starts after a short break. Back in the early 1980s, few Americans had ever heard of the Federalist Society. It was active on just three college campuses, Harvard, Yale, and the University of Chicago, recruiting law students frustrated with what they viewed as left-leaning curricula. Fast forward to 2019, and there are more than 60,000 members, including senators, former ambassadors, cabinet secretaries and attorneys general, and five current and one deceased Supreme Court justices. Some observers think Donald Trump's promise to nominate justices handpicked by the Federalists helped get him elected. Ironically, the group's power and visibility got a jumpstart from a humiliating defeat. Senate Democrats' successful effort to, as the late Senator Ted Kennedy put it, destroy Robert Bork's reputation to keep him off the high court. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That humiliation stuck with a freshman senator at the time, one Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. And as my guest will tell us, McConnell bided his time for nearly 30 years before avenging the defeat of Bork's nomination. The Frontline documentary Supreme Revenge tells the story in detail, and it airs Tuesday on PBS stations around the country. Its director, filmmaker Michael Kirk, joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston to talk about it. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to be here.
So the nomination hearings for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh were outrageous from the start. And I think Americans along the political spectrum on all sides of it were frustrated by that spectacle. This film reminds us that the partisan rancor we saw last fall had been decades in the making. How did putting conservative justices on the court become such a central goal for Mitch McConnell?
Well, I think if you could get in the Wayback Machine with me, and we'll go back to 1987, near the end of the Reagan administration, he'd had some luck with moderate conservatives, Sandra Day O'Connor and others, putting them on the court in an effort to do what he really promised his voters he would do, which is a rollback. What happened with the Warren Court and the Berger Court, which Democrats had pretty much had been surprised by the way the Warren Court worked out. But in fact, a lot of the privacy law, a lot of the individual identity issues that we talk a lot about today were raised and codified by those Supreme Courts. So back then in 87, the Reagan administration decided they would do one more really intense thing, which is bring the toughest, the most visible, the most outrageous in some ways, conservative judge to the court up from the appeals court, the D.C. appeals court, law professor Robert Bork. And when they brought Bork forward, they brought ideology forward. Hmm. And the Democrats were laying in wait for that. And young McConnell himself, a kind of reluctant conservative, but a guy who'd been around the courts a lot as a young intern in Congress in the 60s and working at the Justice Department during the Ford administration, he was paying especially close attention to what happened with Bork.
So Robert Bork in particular struck a lot of Democrats as a threat to progress towards civil rights. What did Ted Kennedy imagine might happen with Bork on the Supreme Court?
Well, Kennedy had, they all had a kind of hint that he was coming, and if he came, it's almost like they had a break the glass speech prepared, because it, and we talked to people who worked for Kennedy at the time, and they actually did have such a speech prepared. They called it, Robert Bork's America. Hmm. And he was going to paint the darkest back alley abortions, setbacks in the civil rights world, really, really, really a dark, dark view of what the future was going to be if Robert Bork was confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. And it was ready to go. Bork had been nominated by President Reagan around 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. A phone call comes from Ed Meese, the Attorney General, directly to Kennedy. I think they knew that Kennedy was somebody who was going to be loaded for bear for Bork. They might as well get it over with. And Kennedy leaves a meeting he's at, runs to the floor of the Senate, takes the 5 minutes he gets, and just lays into Bob Bork. And it is one of those speeches that a lot of people said, including Alan Simpson, the Republican senator from Wyoming, who I've known a long time and wanted to make sure got in this particular film, because he, you know, he had a very strong opinion, and he was there at the time, and he and Kennedy had become close anyway. And he was just shocked, and so were many others, at the vehemence of Kennedy and what the Democrats were obviously determined to do to stop Bork.
Kennedy told Simpson they would have to destroy Robert Bork.
Yes, they really, you know, they'd kind of, as I said earlier, they'd kind of had it their way for a long time. Mm-hmm. And they realized, oh, my God, this Reagan administration is actually getting a lot of things done and determined to do things in the realm of the court. Democrats have never been particularly adept at the court as an issue. Republicans, I think, feeling that the demographics were not working in their favor as they looked off decades ahead, realized that if they could seize control of the Supreme Court and the appeals courts and other federal courts, they could actually affect policy for a generation. And that was what they were determined to do. First, roll back the way the Democrats had been able to do so many things, from school busing to Roe v. Wade and other things, but also, you know, make sure that they enacted much more conservative perspectives on the cases that came before the court after Reagan left. Therefore, it would sort of live a lot longer, and Bork would certainly be that guy. Everything about what he had written and said, thousands and thousands of pages of information, were available to the Democrats if they decided to go to war, and they did.
Before the Bork nomination hearings, Michael, how closely did rank-and-file American voters follow nomination to confirmation processes for Supreme Court nominees? Was this something that people paid much attention to?
I think certain people, of course, but I don't think most Americans. I think, you know, when it came to, I don't think people thought of it as a political institution. In fact, I don't think a lot of people until Kavanaugh really did. Maybe they did a little bit because of Thomas, and maybe as our politics became more and more divisive, people have started to think about it that way. But it really is. So many people I talked to in the course of making this film, we interviewed more than 40 people, and a lot of them said to me, Democrats have never been, especially Democrats, have never been very interested in the courts as an issue in presidential elections or in senatorial elections, because, you know, they've had it their own way for decades and weren't particularly paying attention to this moment. And it was right here. This is, if there was an original sin moment, if you want to call it a sin, it's certainly, if you want to talk about the origin moment of the politics that get fought out in Kavanaugh last fall, was the match was struck here at Bork when the Democrats decided to create a war room, go out and raise money, make it a political issue, get voters educated about who Bork was, even if it wasn't exactly who he was or even close in some cases to who he was or what he represented. They made it a political contest. And as far as I know, there'd been a little bit of this with Carswell and Haynesworth, two Nixon appointees, that just became, the battle was over Nixon and they were going to get his nominees, and in some cases they were vulnerable on character issues. But the it really hadn't been a fight, not the kind of fight we recognize until Bork came along.
And it wasn't just limited to what happened on Capitol Hill. There were like attack ads and op-eds. This was a full court press.
You have Gregory Peck recording ads that are paid for by People for the American Way, which was, you know, the producer of the Archie Bunker show. So Hollywood was involved. You had newspaper ads. You had the very best legal minds, Democratic legal minds, Larry Tribe from Harvard and many others doing murder boards with Kennedy and Joe Biden running the committee. Young Joe Biden running the committee. It's just, I think he was 43 or 44 years old at the time. You literally had all of the ingredients for a first-class TV drama, and that's the way they played it in the same hearing room that the Watergate hearings were held. Out rolls the Robert Bork hearings live on television. All over America for really the first time. It was the Army McCarthy kind of moment around the Supreme Court and this judge named Robert Bork, and the Republicans and Democrats were, as they say, loaded for bear.
It's worth noting that Bork did himself no favors by ignoring the advice about how to testify.
Yes, he was told by the people who from the White House who were, you know, preparing him, be considerate, be quiet, don't go on too long. There were people who asked him to shave off. He had a Van Dyke beard. Mm-hmm. We don't see a lot of Van Dyke beards anymore, but if you look on the web under Van Dyke beard, as I did, I'm sorry, that's how deep I go sometimes. And Van Dyke beard is when they test beards with audiences. Van Dyke beards are viewed as you're viewed as an evil person with sort of negative connotations. But Bork refused to shave the beard, and he refused to listen to them, and decided that it was time to hold a legal seminar for the it was an all white male committee at the time for all of the senators, that he was going to teach them what needed to be learned about the original intent of the framers of the Constitution.
All right, let's listen to Senator Alan Simpson's last question of Robert Bork.
Why do you want to be an associate justice of the United States Supreme Court?
Senator, I guess the answer to that is that I have spent my life in the intellectual pursuits in the law. And since I've been a judge, I particularly like the courtroom. I like the courtroom as an advocate, and I like the courtroom as a judge, and I enjoy the give and take and the intellectual effort involved. It is just a life, and that's, of course, the court that has the most interesting cases and issues, and I think it would be an intellectual feast just to be there and to read the briefs and discuss things with counsel and discuss things with my colleagues. That's the first answer.
So he goes on to say, Michael, that he does want to defend the Constitution, but a lot of people got hung up on that intellectual feast statement. What was wrong with that answer?
Well, I mean, nothing when you play it fully, as you just did, Chris. It's the both a wonderful thing and the terrible thing about an active and free press. The thing that everybody read, the thing that all the reporters jumped up and ran to the Associated Press wires with, was the phrase intellectual feast. And he was roundly mocked for it. There's somebody in our film who says, who worked for Biden, who was the chief of staff for Biden, who says everybody wondered if it's an intellectual feast, who's the dinner? And that was what did it for Bork.
Filmmaker Michael Kirk directed the Frontline documentary Supreme Revenge, which airs Tuesday night on PBS stations around the country. We'll come back to this conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with filmmaker Michael Kirk, who directed the frontline documentary Supreme Revenge, which airs Tuesday night on PBS stations around the country. If you'd like to join us, you can tweet us at KERA Think, or you can call 800-933-5372. So it worked, Michael. Bork lost the support not only of the majority of Democratic senators, but some Republicans as well. What were the concerns about Bork from the right?
Well, some of it is there. It wasn't really the right. There were these people a long time ago in a land far, far away who were called moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. and there were six of them that went. That went the other way on Bork, and some of it had to do with this sense of a kind of intellectual rigidity, maybe that Bork was a sort of elitist. Some of it, they got just terrible responses from their constituents, and they responded to them. And some of them didn't. The moderate Republicans didn't want to give Reagan one more seat on the United States Supreme Court that was such an ideologically hidebound conservative. So all of those things came together, I think, I think the vote was, I can look right here, I think it was Bork was, 42 to 58.
So you have this freshman senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, doesn't have a whole lot of power at the time, but is watching this with outrage and vows to use the same tactics when a Democratic president has the chance to make a key appointment. And as it turns out, McConnell was willing to wait for the perfect opportunity.
He's very good. The people we talked to who have known him all of his life said this was a guy who's, and we've all known someone like this, who thinks way out in the future. Mm-hmm. It's a three-level chess playing when you play with Mitch McConnell. And he, this issue had always been something he really cared about. I mean, I've talked to people who said they think this is his life's work. He was also very big on campaign finance reform. But this is the one. Ever since he was young, ever since he was working on those two confirmation hearings, the Carswell and Haynesworth, ever since he worked at the Justice Department in Ford. And who did he work for? He worked for Robert Bork and Justice Antonin Scalia when they were working at the Justice Department. So he was schooled in both the ideology and in the power and majesty of these men. And when Bork went down in such flames in front of the American people on television, ruined by what a lot of people called his own hubris, but also by the phrase, intellectual feast. McConnell goes to the floor and essentially shakes his fist and says to the Democrats, you will rue the day you have so politicized this process, where a man with his credentials and his, interest and his everything about him should have gotten him confirmed by 96 votes. The fact that you did this, well, you just wait. The day is coming when a president you like or a candidate you want or don't want is coming along, and we are going to get you for this. And of course, the reason we call it Supreme Revenge is he waits a long time to use his revenge card. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little while.
So I want to put a pin in that for just a moment and talk about the Federalist Society. Bork's humiliation seems to have functioned like a recruitment tool for the Federalists. How did the size and the scope of the organization expand in the aftermath of the Bork fiasco?
It was really remarkable. Bork was the advisor of these college students who were like 5 or 10 or 15 students at Yale Law School who said, I've talked to many of them, they said, you just felt out of it. I mean, in every law school in America, they were liberal institutions, and you didn't have any sense of the things you cared about being, taught to you or that they would ever be adjudicated. So at three campuses, as you said earlier, at Chicago, Harvard, and Yale, they had these small groups maybe 20 students in each place, and they had a convention, and it was sort of silly. They said it just felt great to talk to other people who believed kind of what we did. And you can imagine Scalia and Bork being wonderful leaders of such a group. And when Bork goes down in flames, it kind of lights a match for them too. And under the surface, they begin to form up. They start to spread out among out around other campuses. They begin to get money from old school, old money, the Olin Foundation and others. Start to give them enough money to bring speakers in, and they will, of course, eventually explode into being the most formidable force we've ever had in Supreme Court politics and in federal judgeships. The impact is just beyond comprehension, and it all got started back at that moment when Bork went down. The group had existed, but boy, did it get new life and new blood and lots of money from outside groups.
Okay, we'll leapfrog on our timeline now to 1991. Thurgood Marshall announces his retirement from the court, which gives George H.W. Bush, a Republican, the chance to replace a liberal justice with a conservative one. He picks Clarence Thomas. How did the Federalist Society help Thomas prepare for his confirmation hearings?
Well, the first thing they did was bring Thomas forward. There was in the Bush administration, a real disagreement about whether they should go as conservative as and they didn't in the beginning with their first nominee. But by the time Marshall leaves, the Democrats are saying it's got to be an African-American. It should be a Democrat. The seats are sort of divvied up that way in people's minds. And it is the Federalist Society that lobbies very strongly inside the Bush, H.W. Bush administration for not only an African-American, but also a conservative that is blessed by the Federalist Society. And they comb the lists of people who meet the credentials that they had. There were not very many African American conservatives available, and Clarence Thomas was the one they all agreed on, and he would be willing to play the game and not get what is called being borked. He was not going to be borked by the Democrats because he'd play the game the way they wanted him to play it, and that's how Clarence Thomas became nominated.
So he's in this process of confirmation. He's less forthcoming than Bork had been. He plays his cards close to the vest. Things seem to be going really well for him. And then Nina Totenberg of NPR received this information that would turn the whole thing upside down.
She hears Biden, who, by the way, runs this hearing as well as the Bork hearing, and is by now 48 years old, and is and remember, the Democrats are in a little bit of a pickle here because this is an African American man, and they don't want to go too hard on him, even though he's replacing one of their icons, and they don't feel like they can go very hard on him. There's not very much about him that seems vulnerable. He won't answer any questions. He keeps saying, you know, I don't answer hypothetical questions. So they don't really have anything to nail him with. And they each, in their own ways, have other kind of problems. Kennedy, as we all know, had a few character problems of his own at the time. So he was a little chary of going forward and attacking Thomas. But Nina Totenberg hears Biden say, we're not going to talk about personal matters. We're not going to talk about character. No one is making any accusations. And he says it sort of out of the blue. And she thinks, what in the heck? Why is he even talking about this? No one has raised it. There must be something going on inside the committee that I don't know about. So as she says to us, she kicked a few tires and found out what it was. And that is that the story we all know now, which was that a professor who had worked with Thomas at the Equal Opportunity Commission, Anita Hill, had made some allegations in an FBI affidavit about sexual harassment from Clarence Thomas, the very person who was in charge of protecting other American workers from sexual harassment, and it had started to. There'd been a lot of pressure from women's groups and others There's a lot of pressure on the Democrats to go forward and bring Anita Hill in. Joe Biden wasn't exactly interested in making that a huge issue. It eventually, of course, as we all know, does become a major issue. And Thomas is then confronted with the by now familiar accusations of Anita Hill.
There is a really dramatic irony to the fact that this alleged incident, these incidents took place when they were working together at the EEOC. Did Mitch McConnell, did he see this as a plot against a Republican, or did he recognize that it was appropriate perhaps to hear from Professor Hill?
The way I get it from everybody that I could find to talk to about it, including Simpson, who sat on the committee, Alan Simpson, who sat on the committee as well, was that they really didn't believe her. They thought, and I'm assuming McConnell is along because this was the group think, they thought, now this is all white males on both sides, Democrats and Republicans at the time, older white males, they really thought that she was an opportunist, that there were groups, women's groups and others, around Anita Hill that had brought her forward, that were bringing pressure on the Democratic members of the committee to let Hill testify. And it was it put Biden in a kind of hot seat. And I think McConnell and the others decided that if they were going to lose, that if these charges were not answered forcefully, they were going to lose Thomas. And if they lost Thomas, that was going to be a serious problem for them. So they fought back with great intensity against Anita Hill. And Arlen Specter, the senator, was their choice for the strongest prosecutor of Hill and Hill's version of events. And it was not... uniquely up to Specter. Lots of people felt lots of those people, the Republican men and others, felt really strongly that this was not appropriate, that this was an assault on his character, which was a line no one had yet crossed. They didn't like Bork's ideology. They didn't like his politics, but especially his ideology and his manner. In this case, with Anita Hill, the process is digging even deeper, and now it's into the character of the candidate. And that's a bridge no one had crossed yet.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas himself, as we'll hear here, feels personally and unfairly attacked by all this.
This is not an opportunity to talk about difficult matters privately or in a closed environment. This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
That was Clarence Thomas there at his own confirmation hearing. As we know, Thomas was confirmed, has served on the court for nearly 30 years. Was that exchange of words, or that component of his remarks, instrumental in getting him confirmed?
I think there's no question about that. And it was, if you think about the Kavanaugh hearings moving forward at some point, that think about Anita Hill, think about Dr. Ford, think about Clarence Thomas and his pushback. That pushback was essential to him, I think, being confirmed. It's a funny thing. It's like continues to resonate now, as a both a racial comment. I mean, he used race. He played the race card as in his defense. And who can argue with what his perception of what was happening was, independent of Anita Hill? He was talking about the committee. He was talking about something as a defense that it was almost impossible to argue back against, whether it was true or not. And that is another step in this Bork to Thomas and eventually Kavanaugh that we've been watching happening.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Karen on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest thought the ripple effect of the Bork hearings went all the way down to voter alignment of that generation. I know it did for me. I was a young lawyer fresh out of Charles Allen Wright's class, who was originalist, and my understanding for the Bork hearing was there was an entire political party that would hate me. For my understanding of the Constitution.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I think that's a really good, that's a very good point to make. And I think it might be true. There's plenty of evidence that for Republican voters, for Republicans who sided with Bork, for Republicans who didn't like what they saw happening, what happened with Bork, and again, the attack on Thomas, I think locked a lot of people into believing that it's very important that if the Democrats are going to fight this hard, the court must really matter. And we have to defend the judges we want to get on the court. We have to defend our perspective. And this is the place where the conservative perspective will be, that is the courts, will be managed and observed and most effective. Legislation lasts for a term or two. The court lasts for a generation.
My guest is filmmaker Michael Kirk, who directed the Frontline documentary Supreme Revenge. You can see it Tuesday night on PBS stations around the country. If you want to join us, call 800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Michael Kirk. He directed the Frontline documentary Supreme Revenge that airs Tuesday night on PBS stations around the country. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Okay, I'm going to give a quick rundown here as time passes, Michael. Bill Clinton puts Ginsburg and Breyer on the court. George W. Bush adds Roberts and Alito. Obama appoints Sotomayor and Kagan. All along, Mitch McConnell is gaining power within the Senate until he's Senate Majority Leader by 2015. Less than a year later, during Obama's second term, Justice Antonin Scalia dies unexpectedly. And then this is like McConnell's moment to extract payback for what happened to Robert Bork.
This is the revenge moment, or at least part one of the revenge moment. It's a sort of falling action revenge. It happens
right.
Again with Kavanaugh. He decides within an hour of hearing of the death of Scalia, Justice Scalia, that this seat will not be filled by Barack Obama with a liberal, that with 10 months to go in the president's term, he is not going to go out by putting someone on the court who will be there carrying Obama water along with Kagan and Sotomayor for 30 years.
What's so interesting is that Merrick Garland, who was Obama's nominee, was in fact a fairly moderate liberal, right? Obama was seemingly trying to select a justice who would be at least palatable to some Republicans.
I talked to 8 United States senators who would have voted for Merrick Garland, who thought what McConnell was doing, he had a kind of mini revolt on his hands. He had said, we're not only not going to allow a vote about him, we are not going to meet with him. We're not going to do the usual folderol that accompanies a nominee. And Merrick Garland is a sort of moderate to conservative Democrat. He's not even a liberal. And he was a choice that Obama faced the following choice. Do I pick somebody really kind of super liberal and make a point out of this? Or do I pick somebody and make it really hard for Mitch McConnell to stop this person because he would be a great justice? And according from Obama's perspective and from the perspective of many Republicans I talked to, senators, the fact is McConnell fought back really hard. Not going to let it happen. And he held his Republicans together. He did it on Fox. He did it making threats of primarying at least one United States senator. He was, as Nina Totenberg in the film says, he was ruthless and he was brilliant. And he did something no other United States senator or leader of the Senate has ever done. And that is that he stopped a nominee from moving forward from a sitting president.
On what grounds did McConnell refuse to consider the nomination of Merrick Garland?
He said it's 10 months to go, it's not right, it's not fair, and we don't want to do it. There was really, they talk about a kind of precedent. I ask Nina Totenberg in the film tomorrow night, so how unprecedented was this? And she's been watching the court for decades, mm-hmm. and she said totally unprecedented, like shockingly unprecedented, but he got away with it.
So by this time, the Federalist Society has 60,000 members and counting, a $26 million annual revenue stream, extraordinary influence on Republican appointments. Then comes the rise of Donald Trump. It starts to look like, and then it happens, that Donald Trump is the GOP nominee for president. Why was that a potential problem for the Federalists?
Well, they and McConnell. We interviewed Lindsey Graham, who said, you know, none of us really believed that he was a Republican, and certainly we didn't believe he was a conservative. And if he was going to win, he was going to have to prove to Republicans, conservative Republicans, that he was in fact a conservative, and that was very hard for Donald Trump to do. So what McConnell and Don McGahn, whose name will become famous later as White House counsel and in the middle of the Mueller report, McGahn, who is a member of the Federalist Society and a partner in the Jones Day law firm in Washington, a conservatively oriented law firm, McGahn, McConnell, the Heritage Foundation, and the Federalist Society get together with a meeting with Trump, and they say to Trump, "How can we help you?" And he said, "I'd like a list. Give me a list of potential Supreme Court nominees, and I'll wave it around, and we'll make it happen." And that list, created by those groups, the Federalist Society, McConnell, McGahn, and the Heritage Foundation, was the list that Donald Trump, within a couple of days, was waving around. And I interviewed Steve Bannon, and he said, the former chief strategist for President Trump and the campaign, I guess, CEO or whatever, he was chairman of the campaign, he said he believed that this was why Trump won the nomination.
How much of a factor in Trump's actual election do you think the Federalist Society's endorsement was?
Well, it was enough to get him to the end of the race. Mm-hmm. There's so many other things why somebody wins the presidency, especially in a close race like this. Some of it has to do with the Russians. Some of it has to do with Hillary Clinton's failures and the fact that an awful lot of people didn't vote for her, and millions and tens of millions of people voted for him, and that he breached the blue wall in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So there's lots of reasons why it happened. But I think getting over the hump in the beginning, getting the Republican conservative kind of seal of approval of his Supreme Court nominees is something that he did, and it was enough. And it was my personal discoveries of making this film. It really confirmed for me this feeling that a lot of Democrats say, which is the Democrats don't pay enough attention to this as an issue, and the Republicans really do, and it helped Trump win. And it and Hillary and Obama himself, back when he was president, they really, it was very frustrating to the citizens groups who push hard for Democrats to pay attention to what's going on with the courts, that President Obama, who said, I have other things to worry about, I have health care and other major issues, and Hillary Clinton, who herself, an attorney from Yale Law School, didn't throw the kind of emphasis onto it that, and she also thought she was going to win,
right.
So she didn't have to. The really interesting question as we head into the future is, will Democrats pay attention to this, given the lessons that you can learn from watching this film tomorrow night?
Neil Gorsuch was the president's first appointment, and then comes Brett Kavanaugh, who Nina Totenberg in your film describes as the perfect McConnell nominee. Why is that?
Well, moderate in some cases. He's very, very, very conservative on others. He's he meets that test of a certain kind of very experienced. I mean, he worked in the George W. Bush administration. He's got a lot of experience in the closed quarters, those kind of bureaucratic knife fights that happen behind closed doors in the White House and in Washington. He's political. And there's not any justice. I mean, this is something you're just not supposed to say or do, which is have a political justice for the Supreme Court nominee. But he is, and he's earned his spurs politically. And that in lots of ways made him a candidate who could, A, be confirmed very quickly, B, have the support of George W. Bush and others who are more not quite as doctrinaire conservatives, and somebody that that Trump could push along. And remember, when McConnell gets the Kavanaugh nomination, he is in a hurry to get this done. He they don't go away in August. They have to get him confirmed before the October midterms, because McConnell was desperately worried that the Republicans would lose the Senate, and that means that a Democrat would potentially be confirmed to the court. And in order to do what McConnell's final phase of the revenge requires, you've got to have a 5 conservative justice majority on the court.
So as you described it earlier, McConnell saw Anita Hill as an opportunist, didn't necessarily believe her allegations of sexual harassment against Justice Thomas. Do we know how Mitch McConnell felt about the testimony given by Christine Blasey Ford, who alleged that when they were both in high school, Brett Kavanaugh alleged engaged in sexual misconduct against her?
One of the things about McConnell to remember that everybody tells us is he's not a policy guy, and he's also not a character guy. He's a politics guy, and he really sees his job as maneuvering politically and handling the politics of a decision like this. So he's given the job by the President of the United States to confirm this justice. He may have even not thought, let's say he didn't think Kavanaugh was the perfect candidate. He would have still fought hard for whoever the Republicans bring forward, especially if it was a conservative that would help him secure his life dream. So whatever he thought of Christine Blasey Ford, my guess about Mitch McConnell is he sat there and thought, boy, that was a very good performance. And then not in a pejorative sense. She was powerful. She may have moved the needle among the 6 Republicans over on the other side of the panel. He had such a tight, squeaky tight number that he had to hit in order to get there of the Republicans. He had to hold everybody in place, and the President of the United States, who also watched the hearings and was moved by what Dr. Ford said. Everybody in that room that I talked to was moved by her testimony, and most Americans, according to the polls. And so when Kavanaugh came out, it was another Clarence Thomas moment. And what was he going to do? And how would he do it? And I think McConnell would have surely been very interested in making sure that the politics of the situation were played the right way. And we know that Don McGahn, the president's counselor, the Federalist Society member, was in the room with Kavanaugh while they prepared for what Kavanaugh was going to say in response to Ford, in order to, A, speak to the audience of one, which is the President of the United States, on national television, but also Republicans like Susan Collins and Jeff Flake and others who might have been so moved by Dr. Ford's emotional testimony that McConnell could watch it all go up in flames. He was, as Peter Baker from the New York Times told us, he was in as close a fight as he's ever been in those hours between Blasey Ford's testimony and Kavanaugh's rebuttal.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. To the extent, Michael, that today's Supreme Court is as much the McConnell Court as it is the Court of Chief Justice John Roberts, what does that portend for future nominations, whether they come from a Republican or a Democratic president?
I think the thing I learned, which is very interesting, Chris, is, and I've heard this from law professors who watch this very closely, that if the Democrats win the Senate and Donald Trump wins re-election, it's completely conceivable that Donald Trump will never get another nominee, even if, God forbid, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or one of the other justices passes away or retires. It's possible that the court, if there's a Democratic Senate and a Republican president or vice versa, it's completely possible that the court will begin to shrink as the Democrats, as whoever runs the Senate, does not confirm the candidate offered by a president of the opposing party. That's a fascinating moment that hasn't really happened. If you look through the numbers all the way through, as you ran through H.W. Bush, Clinton, George W. Bush, and even the first two nominees of Barack Obama, there was a kind of general sense of, okay, the president gets his choices, and the president's job is to find kind of moderators or whatever kind of people to get passed through it. That has changed going back at Bork. It has changed with Thomas, and it has changed with Kavanaugh. And the Democrats on one side and the Republicans on the other are in a kind of blood sport fight about this that both sides are responsible for. And in a way, there's a thing called the nuclear option, which was, you know, blown up a couple of years ago, and it really means that now it gets harder and harder if the parties are split between the Senate and the White House, and the candidate is in any way Bork-like, Thomas-like, maybe Kavanaugh-like, you're going to find it really hard if you're a president or a Senate to stack the court with one kind or another of a political persuasion.
Filmmaker Michael Kirk directed the frontline documentary Supreme Revenge. It airs Tuesday, May 21st on PBS stations around the country. Michael, always great to speak with you about your work. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think, and we hope you'll subscribe using your favorite podcast app to the Think podcast. You can also check out our website and listen to shows there. It's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.